ties, these human shortcomings, God bringing them out of that, and then right back to a fall narrative. So we see this very consistently throughout the Bible. Saul has his shortcomings. He gets brought up. The people are excited to have a king in Saul, their first king. And then we have Saul's fall narrative of disobeying God in his timing and not being patient and waiting for Samuel and getting nervous and the lack of trust. And then we have David. And up until this point, David has been who we often depict to our kids in the kids' story. I'm not sure what level kids start learning about David and Bathsheba, but it's not the others. So we give this big, we put him on a pedestal, the man after God's own heart, and we can see why. We see his patience and the opportunity where Saul is delivered into his hands on multiple occasions, and David does not take that opportunity to take Saul's life because he says he's God's anointed. And then after this, he gets one kingdom. He gets the tribe of Judah, and he rules over the tribe of Judah. But Saul's son is ruling over the rest of Israel. So we have even this seven-year stretch where we just see Saul's patience exemplified. David doesn't take over the kingdom of Saul's son, large in part to oath he made to Saul, as well as he's incredibly patient with God's timing. So we see all these amazing things portrayed in David, and he prays before he goes into battle, and he listens to God, and he does all these things, and we're starting to just get this balloon picture of who David is. A great guy, man after God's own heart, exemplifies patience, love. I mean, he's just hitting everything right. And then we have his shortcoming. So we're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 11. I'm going to start at the beginning. This is a story we all know. I hope we can bring to light a couple things. And then I don't want to get too far ahead, but this is an incident that carries, right? Who takes over after David? Solomon. Who's the mother of Solomon? Bathsheba. So we'll talk more about that in the future, but I want that to be in our heads when we're reading this story. 2 Samuel chapter 11. In the spring of the year, the time when the kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Raba. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David arose from his couch and walking on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? So David sent messengers and took her. And she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she had been purifying herself from her uncleanness. Then she returned to her house, and the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. So David sent word to Joab. I'm going to pause right there real fast. This has a lot to do with when I say the Bible is repetitive. There's this overarching theme in fall of man. What happens in the Garden of Eden? Eve sees that the fruit is good and she takes it. She sees something's good to her eyes, and what does she do? She takes it. We get into this same language over and over and over again, and that's what I'm trying to portray is, it's David in this moment. What does he do? He looks off of his rooftop onto another rooftop and sees Bathsheba bathing. He sees, and what's the word? He takes her. So over and over and over, when we see this language, it's a false story. It's something that's repetitive. It's giving insights into human nature here. Because as a human, when we see something that's good, if we can, most of the time we're taking it, right? If some food looks good at potluck and some food doesn't look very good, where are we going to try to take? The good, right? So when our eyes perceive that something is good, we try and take. It's human nature. Whether that is a good in the sight of God or not, over and over and over and over, we see the same story. How many times is that our stumbling block in our lives? How many times do we see something and we're like, I know this is what God says, but that looks pretty good right now. That gratification, that instant gratification society, or just quenching a thirst. Because why? We've talked about it the last 2 weeks. I know Kevin kind of dumped the two. He says he didn't do it on purpose. He did. I got to preach on lust and divorce the last 2 weeks, right? Thanks, Pop. But out of the overflow of the heart, what happens? Our actions, what we do. And so when we're filling ourselves with this, when this is prevalent on our mind, and we don't see this in David Pryor, when we see David Pryor, he is wholeheartedly consumed by God. And his actions portray that. When you start putting a little bit of something else, and I think this story is set up very much so that way, because what does it start this whole thing with? In the spring of the year, the time when kings, not king's servants, when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained where? So is David doing his kingly duties? Or is he kind of passing on it, right? He's done some big things, right? They've won a lot of battles. David, from the time he was a young man, what's the bride's price for his wife, Michael? Some young folks just walked in, but I hope we know. He kills 100 Philistines and brings part of them to Saul as a bride price. This is a man who's very successful in war. He's probably enjoyed that success. He's been in tune with God. And then in this moment, he makes a decision. Who has days where they're like, I really don't want to go to work? Right? Most of us. Who has those days where they're like, I know I got a lot of responsibilities. I think I'm just going to take a nap. Right? That's our tendency. Sometimes we just get run down, and I think we start to see this. It portrays it. The Bible's very intentional with the language that they use, and it says, in the spring of the year, in the time where kings go out to battle, David sent Joab. So now he's separated from his role. So we already have this kind of separation from what's supposed to be happening. Something different's happening. And amongst that, when you can already see a little turn of a heart, right? A little turn of something. What happens? He fell. Right? Because once he stopped letting his life be consumed by God, when he's not ruminating a reflection of God, we start putting the world in, what happens? The world comes out. And so we see this just brief stint in David's life where he's not there. We're going to keep reading. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. And Uriah went out of the king's house, and there he called him a present from the king, but Uriah slept. Wash your feet. Uriah in the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord, and did not go down to his house. When they told David, Uriah did not go down to his house, David sent to Uriah, have you not come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? Uriah said to David, the ark in Israel and Judah dwell in booths, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do this thing. What's Uriah saying? Uriah is presenting this. I'm sure in this time David's probably convicted, right? He said, Lord, your servants are out sleeping in booths in the battlefield. The ark, which is at this time, represents the presence of God. Your servants in the ark of the covenant are at war. Why should I come back here and eat and lie with my wife? Right? That's probably not necessarily what David wanted to hear, because what's David trying to do?
Cover up his sin.
Cover up his sin. And isn't it so funny? Who do you have to answer to for your sin? God, not man. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's important that it's Uriah the Hittite. He isn't of the tribe of Israel. He's not of the tribe of Judea. He's lower class, quote unquote, you know, in this time and age. So King David is now being showed up in his quote unquote faith by somebody much higher than a servant. You know, I mean, I think Uriah gets overlooked as a Christian representation in this story, because it's very, don't get me wrong, I'm not downplaying the importance of David's sin and his transgressions, but the scripture very clearly puts what should be occurring here, and I think Uriah gets overlooked a lot in this story.
Yeah, that's a great point. Uriah.
Well, and does anybody know what Uriah means in Hebrew? The fiery sword of God. It's ironic. Not ironic, but it's very poignant that the fiery sword of God, the Hittite, has come back. And what man probably at this point in your period of life, when you're out there warring, wouldn't love to come home and have some comforts, and he chooses not to. It's kind of sorry.
No, that's a great point. In this moment, God's taking what is deemed as a time, a sojourner, right? Living in the land, a foreign land, taking a sojourner and giving him, in this instance, being the reflector of God, as opposed to the man after God's own heart, which exemplified patience, and his nation loves him, and he's won many battles, and he's created this grandeur around Israel, and the guy who everybody looks up to. I like how you said it. People probably don't like that, but he shows them up, right? He is showing his heart for God in this instance. And David, for the past several verses, however long of a stint of time that was, I imagine it was several days. I mean, this isn't just a brief day thing, right? His people are at war, and the war is raging on, and they had to send for him, and Uriah had to come back. There's this stint of time where David's heart is somewhere else. And Uriah comes and exemplifies what David should be doing. So I like that. Again, we have to answer to who for sin. There's only one person. When we're sitting in front of God and he looks upon us, we, hopefully all of us, are going to be sitting, and God's going to look down and see his child covered with the blood of his son. That's who we have to answer to. What is David doing? He's not talking to God. He didn't screw up to start talking to God. He's trying to save face amongst people. He's not talking to the guy he has to answer to. He's saving face amongst people. How often is our first reaction to save face when we do something really dumb? How often is our first reaction to get down on our hands and knees and say, God, I am sorry? How often is our initial reaction to not only talk to God about it, but to talk to the person who we wronged? Right? Because if that was the story, guess what Uriah would have been coming back to? A ginormous apology. And some explaining to do. That's not what he came back to. We're going to keep reading. And David invited him, and he ate in his presence and drank, so that he made him drunk. And in the evening he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of his lord, but he did not go into his house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him that he may be struck down and die. And as Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite also died. Then Joab sent and told David all the news about the fighting, and he instructed the messenger, when you have finished telling all the news about the fighting to the king, then if the king's anger rises, if he says to you, why did you go so near the city to fight? Do you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who killed Abimelech, the son of Jerubasheth? Did not a woman cast an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? Why did he go so near the wall? Then you shall say, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So in this moment, not only did they sacrifice the life of Uriah, sacrificed a lot of men, right? So the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent to tell him. The messenger said to David, the men gained an advantage over us and came out against us in the field, but we drove them back to the entrance of the gate. Then the archer shot at your servants from the wall. Some of the king's servants are dead, and also your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So David said to the messengers, thus shall you say to Joab, do not let this matter displease you, for the sword devours now one and now another. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it and encourage him. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she lamented over her husband. And when her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. The Lord sent Nathan to David. He came to him and said to him, there were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he had brought it up, and it grew with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the land fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Nathan said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you out of the hand of Saul, and I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your arms, and gave you the house of Israel and of Judah. And if this were too little, I would add to you as much more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord to do what is evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and you have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against you out of your own household, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor. And he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son. For you did it secretly, but I will do the same before all Israel and before the son." David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die, nevertheless, because by this deed you have utterly scorned the Lord. The child who is born to you shall die." Then Nathan went to his house. I know I'm going to run out of time. I don't want to go longer. Caleb will give me a hard time. After this, God's promise holds true, right? David goes into mourning, praying, asking God not to take the child. The child is taken as God promised. Then afterwards, you have the birth of Solomon, which, like we said, is the next line of the king. But in this story, I know we've gone over quite a bit already, but in this story, I hope everybody realizes that when God talks to David, he's talking very direct. Who killed Uriah with the sword? David. What did David make it look like?
An unfortunate part of war.
So what matters? Right? Does the matter of the presentation that David probably saved some face to his people? No, we can get so caught up in that, so caught up in what's going on around here, so caught up in, I did this disgusting act, right? I don't want anybody to know about it. But there's no freedom in that. The only freedom you have is in God, in Christ. The only freedom you have is asking for that forgiveness. Because you see, David's next actions are a result of guilt. I'm sure this is eating them alive. Has anybody done something that they carry some guilt with for a while? Probably all of us. Have we ever just went and owned it? Doesn't it feel freeing to just own it? Not comfortable. When I do something dumb, my wife's sitting there and she doesn't know about it. Should I go own it? Yes, because that's going to eat me alive. That's going to roll around in my mind until I do. And David's in this instance where he does just this wretched thing, right? And what does that cause him to do? Just snowball effect, right? We have the instance where he sees and he takes. Again, sees and takes the fall narrative. Eve sees the fruit, it looks pleasing to the eye, and she takes it. David sees Bathsheba, pleasing to the eye, and he takes it. Right now, he's already strike one, right? Strike three, let's just call that three strikes. He's
obligated, if he is reflecting God in this moment, he should have brought Uriah. They should have had a little sit down, shouldn't they? Now the fallout from that, who knows? And again, God, and I don't want to get into this too much because Solomon's coming. But God uses this relationship. And who does he bring up? He brings up Solomon, the next son of Bathsheba. He's protecting this afflicted woman. He's caring for this woman that this act has been done to her dreadfully. When she loses her husband, what's her reaction? She's not excited. David's probably going, whoo. That was a close one. Until he gets reminded that who does he have to answer to? God. We'll all be reminded of that one day. Hopefully we keep that in mind. A lot of people can cover a lot of stuff up. It's the definition you hear in schools. I'm not sure if schools teach character anymore. But character is not what you do in front of people. It's what you do when nobody's looking. Right? And the result of what we do, because we're all susceptible to sin, to mistakes, to separation from God. That's been promised, right? We all fall short. Can't do anything to cover it up with God. When you wrong somebody, what should be your response? Right? Kevin was talking about it a little bit earlier. It's when... I think, I guess it's been 3 weeks ago, if this was. You brought it up that God says, hey, when we're talking about anger, it says if you have anything against your brother, what are you supposed to do? If you're there at the altar with your sacrifice and you have something against your, or your brother has something against you, what should you do? Leave it there and go reconcile. That's the extent of this. Does David portray this in this moment? No, but that's the extent that we're called to be that way. One of my least favorite things to do is apologize. That runs in our family, I guess. I'm not saying anything about you yet. Just kidding. He always has my glass, so I always lose this battle. But it's not easy for us to swallow our pride often, is it? It's not always easy for us to admit wrongdoing. It's not always easy for us to take that on the chin. And usually the darker it is, the harder it is to get off your chest. But the wisdom behind, we're tired, the Sermon on the Mount, we're still going through it in the sermons. The wisdom behind these things that God tells us to do, he's not the I told you so guy, right? When Dad used to tell me something to do, and I was like, well, why did I do that? He's like, because I told you so.
Okay, yes, sir.
I'm not sure that was always my response. Sorry about that. Now I'm starting to realize his point of view with my own kids. I'm more apologetic now than I was when I was younger. But God's not necessarily the I told you so guy. The Sermon on the Mount takes these laws that to us they sound maybe odd or weird, or why on earth is that in there, right? If you read through Deuteronomy, you kind of go, or Leviticus, you kind of go, why? The more you read about it, and if y'all do a study on it, even that outlandish stuff that God tells you to do, it's highly purposeful, right? These laws set up, and I know there's a, Kyle always told me I never believed it, but I do now. To understand Hebrews, you have to read through and understand Leviticus. Right? These things tie in together. These things were written in a way that there has to be, like, you can't just negate part of it. You can't just take bits and pieces. It's a congruent book. This, and I'm getting close, they're about to buzz me. This story of David, I hope we can sit, we can wrestle with it. Because there is, in this short, I always say our curriculum moves super fast. I think it does. Most days I go long and I don't feel like I went through it as well. But I hope y'all read through this, because in this short story, we have so much going on that is indicative of what we do in our lives. The Bible is highly intentional. I think it puts stuff in, like Jason saying that we're talking about a Hittite, or saying the definition of Uriah, or these little things. Give us so much insight. And there's sadly not enough time to go through all of them. Well, y'all have enough time on your own. There's not enough time here today to go through all of them. And the book's already on to the next thing next week, right? But I hope we can sit here and I hope we can wrestle with this. I hope we can see, again, with the Sermon on the Mount, this is something that is dark in David's life. The wisdom God gave for him to own it and move on with his life was not followed here. And what happens is this adultery turns into murder. Oh. Well, adultery is bad. Now pair it with murder. The wisdom behind what God tells us to, the wisdom behind God understands. Who? I mean, sleep is taken from you when you do something, right? If you do something and you're worried about the consequences, oftentimes it's hard to sleep. If you're living your whole life, I told Dad this when I moved back and came to Ottawa. I can't live my life looking over my shoulder. I'd rather be brutally honest with somebody to the point where they're not a big fan of me than to live my life thinking that I gotta look back. Right? The story of David, the shortcoming of David, encompasses a lot of what we've been talking about. It encompasses lust that we talked about a few weeks ago. It encompasses the anger that we talked about. It encompasses a bunch of these things all get boiled up into this one David story. And it's a dark, gruesome story. Not the story we often tell our kids about David. Usually we leave that with David and Goliath.
Hunter, you alluded to it earlier, but it's not lust led to murder. It's shirking responsibility led to, you know, it started off what we would deem as not that big a deal, right? And it escalates from there, but it shows a pattern. Go from this place of menial public cares, you know, to perpetuate it into something much larger.
That's a great point, especially from the start of who's ever shirked responsibility, the outcome turns out all right, and we go, oh, that wasn't that big of a deal. Right? We do that. And I'm sure David in this moment, it starts the whole book off with he sends Joab, and what do they do to the Amorites? They're slaughtering them. Right? And so David's probably going, nice. Right? When I'm not at work and they have a big day at the office, I'm like, nice. David's not at work. He didn't show up today. They're having a good day. He's probably sitting back counting his gold. He's probably sitting back enjoying the creature comforts of his castle. Going, man, this is what everybody wants, right? This build something up to where that's what we talk about. That's what everybody wants, right? You want to be able to have just passive income, or you want to be able to be okay without you showing up every day. You want to be able to do all these things. David's like, woo! I built this place up, right? Starts patting David's back. And God's like, hey, who built this up? Who delivered you from Saul? It says, I delivered you from Saul multiple occasions, not David. The responsibility got twisted. The credit got twisted. He took less of the responsibility, more of the credit. When we're going down that road, that's not a pretty road to go down. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
Yeah, it seems like David just forgot some basic things when he was met with lust. He was such a humble servant as a young lad, and as a new king, he was humble. He used to seek God's guidance on all kinds of things. And then he sought God's guidance after his big failure. But during the time when he was failing and doing really bad, he didn't seek any guidance whatsoever. It was totally driven from pride. Maybe pride was happened before even his lust after Bathsheba. Is that he started off with this, where pride kind of got the control of him. He began to think of himself as the control rather than as God being in control.
And I think we can take that to the micro level and do that, apply that on a day-to-day basis in our lives. Is when things are going good, how easy is it to do this? It's pretty easy, right? You start to think, hey, I got this figured out. There's one thing I've learned about kids is one day you go, I got this figured out. The next day you go, boy, I am a terrible father. So I think that's intentional, right? I think that was put in place to reflect our relationship with God in a lot of ways. But yes, I appreciate the comment. We get into this. If you got a good flow in life and things are going really well, oftentimes we're not saying, thanks, God, for working this out for me. Thanks, God, for giving me these opportunities. Thanks, God, thanks, God, thanks, God. We start to go, good job, Hunter. Wow, do you see what I just did? That's pretty cool. We get twisted up. Pride comes before the fall. I mean, it sounds simple. It really does. But again, it starts with these little things. It starts with these little things. And then, like you said, we often have a tendency to look back and go, hey, God, will you bail me out of this one? Instead of at the first of, as David started being a servant of Saul, being a man in charge of his own small army for Saul, being a king for 7 years of a smaller a tribe, and then joining it all together. Up until this point, it's been before I do something. Before I do something, he's reaching out and asking God's counsel. God, should I go after the Philistines that just pillaged us? God, should I do this? God, should I do that? Then it turns into there's not any asking, right? And this sounds silly, but I think God probably would have answered if David said, Lord, can I stay home from this one? Right? That sounds like a silly little nuance. And he should hopefully be ready for him to be told no. But he didn't even give that opportunity. He just hooked it apart. I'm buzzed twice now. I'm going to stop right now because technically I have 15 seconds before I'm late. Thank y'all for being here. And we'll dig in a little bit further today.